It seems like every other day, astronomers discover some new Earth-like planets.
A possibly habitable world orbiting the closest star to Earth, and that's a really big deal.
Finding a second Earth is not just a matter of if, but when.
Can you imagine all the possibilities of having a new habitable planet? What would we do with it? Maybe we'd use it to raise all our food and harvest its precious metals and petroleum and lumber. Maybe we'd send all our criminals and political enemies there. Or maybe we'd say goodbye to this old Earth and move to that one instead. Earth 2.0, a fresh start. What would that look like? After all our trial and error on Earth 1.0, how would Earth 2.0 be different if we had a chance to reboot our civilization, to build new institutions and systems from scratch, whether on a new planet or this one? What would we do? What would our political and economic and medical and educational systems look like if we weren't stuck with all the residue of the past few millennia? That, my friends, is the theme of today's episode of Freakonomics Radio. And not just today's episode. This Earth 2.0 thought experiment is so big and exciting, to me at least, that we're going to make a series of episodes on this topic. They'll come at you over the next several months. We'll start today with, what else? Economics. We'll hear from some of the most esteemed economists in the world.
Well, that thought experiment's not so far from how I think about things day to day.
We ask a Nobel Prize winner what he'd do as chief economist of Earth 2.0.
Well, you know, I would turn the job down.
But we press on, undeterred.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
There are at least two scenarios when a thought experiment can be a useful thing. The first is when you're hoping to navigate an unpredictable future. The second is when you're trying to reimagine the past. The thought experiment we're undertaking today, Earth 2.0, involves both. If we had a chance to reconstruct our economic system, how would it differ from what we've already got? The reason this is a thought experiment, not an actual experiment, is that unless you're a dictator, you generally aren't allowed to simply blow up an existing system or institution and invoke your will. And the systems we've got, as much as we may be accustomed to them, aren't necessarily optimal. They've evolved over thousands of years, often quite randomly, sometimes by diktat, occasionally by pure accident. And once a given practice or custom is in place, it can be devilishly hard to change it, even if any rational person can see it's ripe for change. Why? Because of what's called path dependency, which means that once a path is worn into the ground, it's awfully hard to deviate. You can see this in examples large and small, which is why it's so tempting to pretend we could just start over from scratch.
Okay, my name is Angus Deaton, or if you want the full formality, Sir Angus Deaton, and I'm a retired or emeritus professor at Princeton.
Deaton won a Nobel Prize in economics in 2015 for his analysis of consumption, poverty, and welfare. So our mission today, Professor Deaton, is pretty straightforward. We throw out all our existing systems and institutions on Earth and build new, more perfect ones from scratch. So knowing what you know about economics, what changes would you make? Let's just start there with the broad question.
Well, I'm actually quite hostile to the question. You know, I don't really believe in this sort of social engineering that's implicit in the question, and that, you know, that can very easily turn into a form of tyranny, especially when it's done in a non-democratic or non-organic way. So that, you know, I think, you know, when you ask a question like that, you think, ooh, wouldn't it be nice to have a world government or something? Well, the answer is it would not be nice to have a world government. You know, local governments can be tyrannical enough before you start. So I really do sort of believe in organic development.
So rather than saying, let's throw out Earth 1.0 and start from scratch and institute some, as you disdainfully suggest, some centrally planned, you know, over economy, how would you assess overall the success of this spontaneous, orderish series of economies that have evolved organically?
Pretty highly, I think. I thought you were going to go somewhere slightly different, but let me give the answer to that question too, which is that I'm always a little worried when people say, you know, why can't we be more like Sweden? Or, you know, why does Germany succeed whereas Japan doesn't? I think what is very important, and it's part of the organic development, is that, you know, these countries are different from one another largely, I think, because people want it that way. And, you know, for example, a healthcare system that works in Britain, it may just not work at all for Americans because tastes and habits and things that people have accepted for a long time. And also their history. I mean, people who go through wars often feel differently thereafter than people who don't. I mean, I don't think Swedish tastes are fixed or Scottish tastes are fixed, but I think they're real enough. And so, you know, one of the dangers of trying to come in with a template and re-engineer the world is that they often don't recognize those facts, whereas the organic growth really does.
Now, where did you think I was going to go with that question?
Well, sort of, you know, which country do you think would be the template for, you know, a new nation 2.0 or something?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Which country would then?
Well, none. You know, the ideal country for Americans is different from the ideal country for Swedes. That's not to say each one's got its ideal country. I mean, people would like some improvement, I think.
Yeah. So keeping in mind that I very much respect your desire to not blow up the system and start over, if I were to make you the, let's say, chief economic advisor of Earth 2.0 and give you the task of writing up the kind of elevator pitch for some rules to live by, some things that you definitely want to do and some things that you definitely don't want to do, just give me a few things on the plus side and a few things on the negative side.
Well, you know, I would turn the job down, what I would do. And it's partly because, you know, I do have a track record of turning down similar, not quite so global jobs. But, you know, I do think it's just a bad thing to do, especially at that level. And I think it would make me into a tyrant. It would breed hubris. And, you know, I'd do more harm than good.
Well, that thought experiment's not so far from how I think about things day to day.
We did find an economist who is open to our proposition.
I'm Jeff Sachs. I'm a professor at Columbia University and special advisor to the United Nations Secretary General on Sustainable Development.
Sachs has also been an advisor to the Vatican and many heads of state. He's considered a sort of poverty-fighting superhero. He's run economic and humanitarian rescue operations all over the world.
I went into economics believing that it ought to be useful, and it ought to be useful for addressing big challenges.
To that end, Sachs has a clear vision of the goals that economists should be helping to achieve.
Economic prosperity, social fairness, and environmental sustainability. And while that's not perhaps the most abstract vision of the world, I think it's a pretty good shorthand for where we stand in the 21st century of what we ought to work on. Now, how do you actually do that in the world? You don't do it top down because everyone's circumstances are quite different. But I'm a big believer in that framework. You could call it a moral framework if you want, but I really believe in that if we think together in our best mode as human beings, in the mode of problem solving, these are really solvable problems. Let's do something that is, you know, became anathema for some market economists, and let's hold ourselves accountable by measuring every year, what are we doing? Are we more unfair, less unfair?
Which country at this moment in time that we're speaking do you feel has the best blend of politics, economics, and social structure?
That's easy because three countries come up at the top of every list, whether it's happiness or sustainable development, and those are the Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Norway, Denmark. They're market economies, but they're also social democracies. They tax a lot, and they guarantee access to a lot of services, health, education, daycare, childcare, vacation time, family support, and so forth. And in my view, they work the best on the whole planet.
Of course, not everybody, not even all economists, agree with Jeff Sachs's assessment. He is pushing for a highly regulated and curated market economy, regulated and curated typically by a central government, whereas others advocate for minimizing the role of government.
I am unapologetically in favor of free markets.
That's Brian Kaplan. He's a professor of economics at George Mason University.
I think free markets not only work well, but they're also just the fair and just way for people to deal with each other.
This brings us to a central question for Earth 2.0 economics. Should we rely on free markets and Adam Smith's famous invisible hand, or a more visible hand? And if the latter, just how visible should the hand be, and whose hand is it?
People often think about free markets as being unfair to the poor or unfair to, probably especially the poor. And what I would just say is, if you really look at the regulations that really change the world a lot, like immigration restrictions, they actually are a case of governments trying to stop the poor from bettering their own lives.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, which economic ideas are worth porting over from Earth 1.0 to Earth 2.0, and which ones should be killed off?
I wish I knew the answer to that.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Today, we have embarked on a thought experiment that we will revisit over several episodes, over several months. It's called Earth 2.0. If we had the opportunity to reboot our planet and create new systems and institutions from the ground up, how would they be better, or at least different, from what we've blundered our way into through trial and error? We asked you, our Freakonomics Radio listeners, what you think is particularly ripe for reinvention. Before we get back to our discussion on economics, let's hear some of your ideas.
One thing I've always wanted to reboot is how we define adulthood in America. When you turn 16, you can legally drive a car, but you can't consent to have sex in the back seat of it. They're sort of arbitrary milestones, and they don't account for the fact that people have different levels of maturity. There are really mature 17-year-olds and really immature 25-year-olds. So what I'd like society to do is to treat adulthood the same way it treats marriage, as a contract between individuals and the state.
The first institution I would like to give a serious restart is the academia, where a typical professor wears four hats: the researcher, the teacher, the advisor, and the bureaucrat slash politician. As one rarely excels in all four domains, this system tolerates mediocrity and pushes talented people out.
The system I would change, if I could change anything, would be the global mathematics system, from a decimal-based system to a duodecimal or dozenal-based system. I believe more people understanding basic math concepts can only better society, but people struggle now because a base 10 system is hard and pretty messy. You can't even divide by 3 evenly. A base 12 system is a much cleaner system, which means more concepts of division and multiplication will be understood faster by more people.
The institution that I believe desperately needs to be overhauled is the modern legal system. I believe it is unnecessarily elaborate. It looks down upon simplicity and is far removed from the understanding of common people.
The financial incentive for doctors to provide expensive tests and procedures which may not be in the best interest of the patient. Like any first-year student of economics, or Freakonomics, would know, a misalignment of incentives can cause major problems for any system.
I think there's an institution that badly needs an overhaul, and it's democracy itself. Everyone says the system is broken, but I would say that it's simply antiquated, and that the advances of artificial intelligence can bring a solution.
All right, maybe we'll look at some of those ideas in future episodes. For now, let's get back to Earth 2.0, Economics Edition. So let me ask you a question. What share of the current global population do you think lives in extreme poverty? Go ahead, pick a number. Also, would you say that number has gone up over the past few centuries, or gone down? By a lot or by a little?
that's really something that very few people actually know. If you do surveys, it's maybe 10-12% of the population that actually knows that the share of the world population living in extreme poverty has decreased.
That's Max Roser. He's an economist at the University of Oxford. So if extreme poverty has decreased, how bad was it a couple hundred years ago?
If we go back 200 years, then we have basically the entire world population living in material conditions that we would call extreme poverty by the standards of today. So 80-90% of the world population. But still, even in the beginning of the 1980s, more than 40% of the world population live in extreme poverty.
And today?
And today they're roughly 10% of the world population still living in extreme poverty. And that's, of course, a tremendous achievement, but it still means that 10% of the world today live in extreme poverty. And the name extreme poverty is really appropriate. It is a very, very low poverty line. So it's for sure no reason to be complacent about that. And there's still a lot of work to be done.
So yes, there's still lots to be done. And while the share of people living in extreme poverty has fallen to around 10%, 10% of a population that has ballooned to 7+ billion is a lot of people. That said, it would be foolish and ungrateful to deny this massive economic progress, which is why some economists, like Nobel laureate Angus Deaton, don't really like our thought experiment of rebooting the economic system.
Well, I'm actually quite hostile to the question. I really do sort of believe in organic development.
But that doesn't mean there aren't plenty of problems to address.
I've been focusing much more about issues of rent seeking. And it seems to me that in an economy like America's today, we have whole sectors in which rent seeking is very deeply embedded. The healthcare sector being perhaps the most obvious one. In which, you know, we have a health care system in the United States, which is not very well set up to save lives or to keep people healthy, but which does make a lot of people very rich. It is incredibly expensive. And, you know, I think we're in a terrible place as far as that is concerned right now.
Unless you're an economist or a kind of econo-nerd, the phrase rent-seeking, I found, means almost nothing to you. So I'd love you to talk about it, just define it for a moment. And then I'm really curious to hear from you whether you feel it is an inevitable byproduct of a certain kind of economy or a certain kind of economy-slash-political setup.
I wish I knew the answer to that. Those are great questions. I had the opportunity to talk to a bunch of cardinals in Rome, and I talked about rent-seeking and crony capitalism.
That was brave.
It was very brave. And there were people were just falling around hysterically laughing that, you know, I would dare to say this. But it was quite safe, in fact, because the translators just translated it as something nonsensical. And I'm sure they had no idea what I was talking about at all. But, I mean, another term for rent-seeking is crony capitalism, or more precisely, directly unproductive activities. And so what rent-seekers do is they go to government and they get special favors like monopolies or, you know, protection from people who would compete against them, or especially high prices for their products, or rules that say no one can bid down the prices of their products. So they get protection from the market. So it's a sort of anti-market thing. And in a rent-seeking society, you know, if you're running a business, like, say, a pharma company or something, you could invent new drugs, which would make people live longer and, you know, make you worthily rich. Or, you know, you can go to Washington and beg for special favors. And that's often a much more profitable activity. But it doesn't provide anything for anyone. And, you know, Mansur Olson, who was an economist and political scientist, he wrote a very, very wise book about how this would bring down capitalism in the end, and that as societies got richer, these groups would form whose main purpose was simply to enrich themselves at the expense of everybody else. And of course, that reduces economic growth, and it also causes the political system to be captured by rich people. And so, you know, if we could wipe out rent seeking at a stroke, we would reduce inequality by an enormous amount, because a lot of the people who are really rich are rich because of rent-seeking, not because of stuff they invented. And of course, it's complicated because the inventors turn into rent-seekers very quickly if you don't watch out.
Can you talk about what you see as the kind of sane blend of open markets and government regulation? Maybe there's an example from today where you think there's a good symbiosis, or maybe from history, maybe even antiquity.
I really don't know. And I wish, I mean, if you could recommend me a good book that treats that question, I would love to read it. But, you know, I've read a fair amount, but I'm not sure that that question has been that well answered. And it's also these rent-seeking and crony capitalism ideas are not that widespread in economics, or maybe, again, I'm missing it.
It sounds, my interpretation, I may be misinterpreting it, I seem to hear you say that rent-seeking is an inevitable result of an economy or a political economic system that grows so rich and prosperous and fat that there's plenty of people who can come in and extract some of that fat without anybody really being able to do anything about it.
No, I'm not. I don't believe that, I don't think. I mean, you could take, say, Sweden, that's as rich as we are, or very close, and has a very large government, and there's lots of regulation, so you would have thought this would be an opportunity for more rent-seeking. But people in Sweden trust their government and don't seem to think it's being undermined this way. And it may be worse in the U.S. because people mistrust government. I don't know. I really don't have a well-developed hypothesis here.
You've got to respect and appreciate Angus Deaton for not pretending to know the solutions to hard problems like rent-seeking. The fact is that economics, as much as it considers itself a science, is often not very scientific. If it were, there'd be a clear answer to a straightforward question like, what's the best way to stimulate growth?
I have no idea. I don't know how to stimulate growth.
That's Abhijit Banerjee.
I teach economics at MIT and I'm a director of the Abdul Latif Jameel Poverty Action Lab.
When Banerjee says he has no idea how to stimulate growth,
I'm not sure there are many very clearly identifiable good things we could do. I know how to destroy growth. North Korea knows how to destroy growth. I think what we can do is avoid disasters. I think having an underclass that's resentful and excluded is a disaster. I think the real, you know, salient issue of today is income distribution. And I think if we did not do something about income distribution, we just continue this promise that, you know, in the long run, it's all going to be good for you. You just have to bite your lip and bear it. That's what we've been telling the poor for 40 years now. And it's going to all be better because we know what it is. And again, we're giving them the same recipe, which is basically we're going to do a few things like, you know, bully some companies to not move abroad or something. But then most of it, we're going to give tax cuts to the rich. We're going to get maybe some growth. But the big picture of it is that, you know, even if we raise growth rate from 3% to 4.5%, we're not going to change the big problem of a massive unequal income distribution.
This points, once again, to a central conflict among economists and others. How to strike the balance between free markets and a more paternalistic state, between creating opportunities for everyone without tamping down the incentives to innovate and work hard. Jeff Sachs, as we've heard, is firmly in favor of a helping hand more than an invisible one.
Part of my solution for extreme poverty is take money from rich people and give it to poor people to help them do things.
That is, he wants to address an economic failure by exploiting our collective economic success.
We're just phenomenally rich. It's unbelievable. And we therefore have solved, in the macro average sense, what John Maynard Keynes called the, quote, economic problem, meaning we don't need extreme poverty, we don't need suffering from deprivation anywhere in our world.
Meanwhile, Angus Deaton, while hardly opposed to alleviating suffering, sees financial aid as a slippery slope, especially on the national level.
Well, I don't think we should be spending large amounts of money inside other people's countries. which is not to say, that's not an argument, it's against aid. It's just, you know, I think it was Jagdish Bhagwati who coined the term that, you know, we should be giving aid for Africa and not aid to Africa. And, you know, it's very, very difficult. But smaller countries and much of Africa, you know, gets the better part of all of government expenditure comes from abroad. And then that means the government is basically in hoc to the donors and need not pay much attention to its own people. And it sort of converts governments into rent seekers, as it were. And, you know, even if you start out with good leaders, you know, opening up this giant fire hose of money in their country, that's a much easier trough to feed at than actually setting up firms and entrepreneurs and actually doing something. And even if you start with good leaders, they're likely to turn into bad leaders. And if you start with bad leaders, you're forming an alliance with them to exploit their own people. And, you know, we've seen that over and over again. But, you know, just so that I don't go down an entirely negative way, we could spend a lot more money in Washington, D.C. or in London on researching diseases that don't really affect Americans very much. You know, malaria, for instance, but which do make life miserable for millions of people around the world, and where we could make their lives a lot better. So, I mean, I accept the obligation. I really do think if people are suffering, we all owe an obligation to do something about that if we can. But we don't have an obligation to hurt them in the name of making ourselves feel a warm glow.
Big sigh. Looks like life on Earth 2.0 won't necessarily be any simpler than on 1.0, at least as far as economics is concerned. Coming up, the future of work and the future of economic problem solving.
That not only did something great for the employees, it also set a standard for other businesses there.
That's next on Freakonomics Radio.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We like to ask questions on this program, sometimes questions that are, to be honest, unanswerable, like today's question. If we had the chance to totally reboot our economic system, what would that new system look like? Why do we bother with a question that may strike you as absurd? The MIT economist Abhijit Banerjee says it better than I ever could.
I have no blueprint for a better world, but I think that doing things consciously, with thought, asking lots of questions, not doing them because this is how we've always done things, this is our tradition, this is the normal in the world, asking questions, why do we do these things? Is this the right thing to do? What is the actual evidence for it? That's key. We won't have a blueprint for the world, but we will have a better way of building a better world.
So let's ask a question that a lot of people are asking these days. What should be done about income inequality?
Inequality has been proven to be a problem for economies, and it's a problem for countries, and it's a problem for sports teams.
That's Rosabeth Moss Kanter of the Harvard Business School. She trained as a sociologist, but is best known today as a management sage.
One of the striking things about sports teams on losing streaks is that losing teams often had stars, just like third world countries have rich people, even though most people are poor. Losing teams have stars, even though the team isn't winning. The difference is that the stars look out for themselves. They feel no obligation to lift up the other players, to teach them, to include them. They only care about their own record. Just like rich people in an African country can take their money and go park it in Switzerland or the Cayman Islands and not care about lifting up their country. Whereas on winning streaks in countries as well as sports teams and companies, generally those at the top feel some obligation toward the education, the training, the development of people below them. So just to make things work well, inequality doesn't help. And then if you have a lot of people who feel left out of the system, Well, they do get angry, and they sometimes surprise you with their feelings, but also they often go passive. They think nothing could be done to change anything, and because of that, they're not very motivated, and nothing does change.
That's a compelling argument, to be sure, but not everyone shares Cantor's views on inequality.
It's definitely the kind of problem that we should just worry a lot less about.
Brian Kaplan is an economist at George Mason University.
So again, like the main predictor of living standards of not just most people, but the poorest people in a country is productivity in that country. Countries that produce a lot of stuff aren't just good places to be rich or middle class, they're good places to be poor. You know, so when people complain about people being left behind, well, you know, like, you know, China's got 1.3 billion people. Sure, someone's going to be left behind in there. But is it better to be poor now in China than it was 20 or 30 or 50 years ago when people are starving to death? There is really no question. So you know, it's only by going and, you know, forgetting history, forgetting comparisons, and then searching through a vast number of people to find a sad story that we can forget the big picture, which is really what we should be doing at all times. And what is the big picture? Not that we can find something that happened that is bad in a world so vast we can't even imagine it, but saying what is happening overall, you know, what is the general trend, and how can we keep the general trend good?
Again, it's a reminder that overall, the prosperity curve is still rising. But still, as some countries and people become incredibly rich, isn't it natural to try to close the gap beneath them? A few months back, I had a chance to put this question to Sir Angus Deaton, an emeritus professor of economics at Princeton. Deaton won a Nobel Prize in 2015 for his analysis of consumption, poverty, and welfare. I'd love to talk for a moment about inequality, the degree to which it is inevitable, perhaps the degree to which it is desirable, and the parts of it we should worry about and those we shouldn't.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I just spent last week in Davos being asked nonsensical questions like, how do we kill inequality? You know, how do we remove inequality? And, you know, I'm just not sure that inequality is the right concept in that it has so many sides to it and so many causes and so many effects that focusing exactly there doesn't seem to be the right thing. In fact, I just got something from some social organization today which said we define inequality as stagnant wages, you know, which is a very, very odd definition of inequality. I mean, inequality, you know, is about the spread to some extent, you know, the dispersion. So taking it from there, I think there's always going to be some inequality, at least in the worlds in which we live. There is this interesting fact that for most of human history, in which we were all living in hunter-gatherer bands, there appears to have been almost no inequality. And yet from farming onwards, from the Neolithic Revolution, there's been a lot of inequality. And, you know, even in the perfect Rawlsian world where you're trying to maximize the welfare of the worst off, you would need some inequality because otherwise the worst off person, like everybody else, would have nothing. So, I mean, that's just a simple economic story as to why there ought to be some inequality. If you go all the way back to the Athenians, there was the question as to whether extreme income distribution, wealth disparities were not compatible with a functioning democracy. And if they were, what sort of democracies could you have? And could you design constitutions that would somehow contain that? So that's sort of a separate question, which economists don't typically think about very much.
What we know about the history of human society for at least 4,000 years is we've grappled with the same types of problems.
That's James Robinson. He's a political scientist and economist at the University of Chicago.
You know, if you go back to the Epic of Gilgamesh, I think the first version of that is about 2100 BC, it's all about the same thing. You know, how can you create authority, hierarchy, which is very important for providing public goods, cooperation, protection against attack, etc., but control hierarchy? So I think the problems starting a new society would be, how do we create this system of authority? How do we keep it under control?
Robinson is the co-author, along with Daron Acemoglu, of an important book called Why Nations Fail. In it, they try to propose a simple way.
A simple way to think about why some societies are successful economically and other societies are not. And, you know, really that's about
the institutions of a society. You know, to be economically successful at some level, economists understand very well what that involves. You know, it involves innovation, it involves investments in education and capital, entrepreneurship. And we know that human beings, you know, and I don't need to tell anyone associated with Freakonomics this, human beings respond to incentives. But the incentive systems in different societies are very, very different because of their institutions. So the institutions that create all this prosperity and innovation in the United States are absent in other parts of the world. And the reason for that is fundamentally, in our view, political. You need to have the right sort of politics and political institutions if you're going to create economic institutions that create broad-based incentives and opportunities and that create prosperity.
That's probably not very surprising to hear, that it's hard to build a good economic infrastructure without a good political infrastructure. But Robinson, digging deep into economic history, did find some surprises.
There's some interesting lessons from the colonial experience.
For instance,
we're interested in these big questions about, you know, why has North America been so successful economically than South America for the last 200 years?
The U.S. and Canada, colonized primarily by England, have done far better than a lot of Latin and South American countries colonized by Spain, for instance. The key is what Robinson calls inclusive institutions. The English colonial model often called for integrating laborers into their system of production and trade, whereas, say, the Spanish colonies...
more likely were based on the idea of extracting wealth from other people or taking a lot of resources out of the ground.
That's Tyler Cowan, an economist at George Mason University. As Cowan and Robinson see it, the North American colonies flourished because their institutions placed a high value on human capital, their settlers, that is, rather than the exploitation of a native population. And, the argument goes, that difference still persists, which would explain why there's still such intense political friction in much of Latin and South America between the elites and the underclass. The U.S., of course, has its own history of slavery in the South. Interestingly, Robinson points to the greater poverty in the South as further support of his argument against an economic system that's built on exploitation. Now, the days of wholesale colonization are, of course, long gone, at least for now. But if we are considering a more perfect economy for Earth 2.0, surely it would be wise to think about the lessons learned from those earlier colonizations and to look for modern parallels. For instance, a company isn't a country, but how a company treats its employees, its partners, its customers, well, that must have some bearing on how an economy develops.
Multinational corporations have a very important role to play in developing countries.
Rosabeth Moss Cantor, again, from the Harvard Business School.
There are some, certainly, that exploit, and it depends on the industry. When the only reason companies would go to developing countries was for the natural resources, for mining, for oil, then they would extract those natural resources and leave. What did they care about how they treated their employees? But when companies go because they see a business opportunity, there's a market for their goods and services, or a workforce that they could educate to do things to world standards and supply other markets in that region, then they have to treat people differently. And they definitely can make a big difference. I remember when Procter & Gamble was building up its business in Egypt, and one of the things P&G did, because their employees all over the world had health insurance, they worked in Egypt to make sure there was a good health insurance scheme in Egypt so they could give it to their employees too. And that not only did something great for the employees, it also set a standard for other businesses there. So multinationals that bring in values and bring in best practices from other parts of the world can educate that country and be a very big part of their development.
The key, Cantor says, is to treat people like people and not like physical resources to be plugged into your business model.
So that, I think, is crucial.
James Robinson again.
If you're going to set up a society on a new planet, you don't want to have the government running itself off the labor of robots, you know, or mining rents, or you have to set up an economy where everybody is needed, everybody is valued. And I think that's a big lesson from these successful experiences.
An economy where everybody is needed, where everybody is valued. How do you do that? Especially as new technologies make so many old jobs obsolete. We are living through an era of astonishing technological advances, including automation and robotization, and it is rattling labor markets all over the world.
A recent study by Oxford University says nearly 50% of current U.S. jobs are in danger from automation.
What can we do to protect ourselves from robot automation?
But for some, the rise of the robots could lead to a sea change in society that we haven't even begun to anticipate.
The most susceptible jobs tend to be lower paying jobs, which means that lower income workers who are already doing worse than average will be put at even greater risk. That, at least, is how some people see the future of work.
My name is Eric Olin Wright. I'm a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin, where I have taught since 1976.
Whether it's because he's a sociologist or because his worldview has been informed by Marxism, Wright has a different view than most economists about our worst economic problems.
Well, I suppose among the most glaring is the concentrations of power that come along with the concentrations of wealth that are characterized by a global economic system with gigantic corporations that are able to amass vast sums of money, capital, which enable them it's not simply that this enables them to act in markets in a particularly destructive way sometimes, but it enables them to wield power outside of markets as well. If you took the top 10 corporations in the United States and called them a country, they would be roughly the eighth wealthiest country in the world. So our corporations are really political entities. And I think of that as a huge failure, because of the way in which it dramatically undercuts democratic values and egalitarian values.
What kind of solution would Wright propose?
If we had social policies in place that distributed the gains from trade in a broadly egalitarian manner, I don't think people would be in favor of protectionism at all. They would see that, international trade has broad benefits, not narrow benefits.
What kind of social policies is Wright talking about?
An unconditional basic income, which you could pay for out of the gains from trade, right?
We've also looked at this topic before on Freakonomics Radio. The episode was called, Is the World Ready for a Guaranteed Basic Income? That was only a year ago, but since then, interest in the idea has been cascading. Eric Olin Wright sees it as win-win.
Well, let's use a significant part of that increased wealth of the society generated by the economist's favorite free trade and provide an unconditional basic income for everybody. My view is an unconditional basic income should be pegged at, you know, a bit above the poverty line. Think of it as the sort of no frills but decent standard of living. It gives people a different kind of freedom from what they have in an ordinary capitalist market. It lowers the coercive pressure on people to work. But it doesn't reduce the incentive. If you work, you earn more income, right? So it's true, there'll be some people who will be perfectly happy to live just on the basic income. But there's no disincentive to earn more. You know, it's not like means-tested poverty grants where if you start earning money, you lose your welfare. You don't lose your basic income. Everybody gets the basic income. Bill Gates gets the basic income.
So I'm very strongly against the universal basic income.
That's Brian Kaplan again from George Mason.
Saying let's give everybody free money, no matter what, people perfectly able-bodied, people perfectly able to take care of themselves. That to me just seems great, you know, crazy at the outset. But more importantly, if you just do a small amount of math and realize how much would it cost, the cost is enormous. Right now, the welfare state, we're able to keep the cost down because we don't give money to everybody.
Kaplan, as you've probably deduced, leans more libertarian than Marxist, but his argument isn't only mathematical.
So I am old-fashioned enough to really like the distinction between the deserving and the undeserving poor. And right now, we have a lot of very expensive government programs that give money to everybody eventually. So, you know, old age programs. Social Security writes checks to Bill Gates like anybody else. And again, to me, this is insane. Why tax everybody to pay for them in a situation that everybody knows they'll eventually reach as long as they don't die young? Thinking about kids and the elderly in the same breath is crazy. Like kids, you're born an orphan. There's nothing you could have done about that. So that's totally not your fault. But if you are starving when you're elderly, then there's a question, well, why didn't you plan for this, which was totally foreseeable in every way?
You may not be surprised to learn that Kaplan also has a different view of the labor markets generally. For starters, he's in favor of more immigration and more open borders.
Why trap perfectly good talent in Haiti or Congo or India or wherever it happens to be born when it can do so much more in another part of the world, enriching not only the immigrant, which is what we usually focus on, but enriching the world just by producing more stuff? Whenever I'm talking to undergraduates, I always say, look, you know, first rule of economics, you know, keep your eye on production. If you produce a ton of stuff, mankind will be rich. If you produce a small amount of stuff, mankind will be poor. And anytime you're trying to analyze a complex problem, just forget all the other stuff at first and just say, well, what does this do to the productivity of mankind? If it's higher, then this is a good thing that we should be rooting for. If it's lower, it's a bad thing that we should not be rooting for.
But what if the production of all that stuff comes at the expense of the people who, historically, have made that stuff? What if entire classes of work are swept away by technology? Driverless vehicles, for instance. In the U.S. alone, a few million people make their living as drivers.
Say, you know, driverless cars, isn't that going to threaten the jobs of drivers? Yeah, it totally threatens the jobs of drivers. And we totally want driverless cars right here, right now, to be awesome because it will enrich mankind. And if you sit around thinking about the few people who lose from progress rather than all the people who gain, you'll never get anywhere. We would really be back in the Stone Age if every time someone came up with an idea, we sat around saying, yeah, but whose job could be lost as a result of this? That's just the kind of thought that needs to be suppressed because it leads to a world of poverty and misery.
Kaplan may sound a bit more doctrinaire than even most economists are used to hearing, but when it comes to the relationship between prosperity and technology and the future of work, most economists we spoke with for this Earth 2.0 thought experiment were roughly in agreement, especially about the idea of a universal basic income.
I'm not one who would move in that direction.
That's Alice Rivlin. She's an economist who's had big jobs at the Federal Reserve and the Office of Management and Budget.
I think we've got to get people working and producing and being valuable rather than just subsidizing people not to work.
It's not that Rivlin thinks that old-style manufacturing jobs will come back.
It's not likely because technology has changed so rapidly and it is more efficient to produce a lot of things with more technology or over in different places.
But, she says, there's an opportunity to be had.
What we should be focusing on, I think, is the people that we need in a service economy to do really important jobs for improving our quality of life. One is very well-trained people to work with small children, early childhood nurturing and education we know now is really, really important. And yet we are not paying a living wage to people who take care of children in daycare centers and in early childhood education. We should find a way to professionalize those jobs, recruit people who have had more training and who can earn higher wages. And there are lots of other examples of that in healthcare, in care for the elderly. We have an awful lot of people now who are living for a very long time, and many of whom need care. And they don't just need warehousing in a nursing home. They need interesting things to do and be part of and a caring atmosphere. And that takes people with skill, and it takes people that are paid enough. And we haven't figured out how to make these human service jobs into really important parts of our economy that are well compensated. That's a big challenge.
One of my ethical precepts is that everybody should be carried along, broadly speaking. In other words, if we're rich, we don't have to have people suffer.
That's Jeff Sachs again. He is one of the most decorated economists of the past half century. He's worked with the UN, with the Vatican, with countries all over the world, mostly on fighting poverty.
And the fact that we can't figure that out, that to my mind is really a failing of our moral insight, not a failing of kind of economic technique per se. If jobs are going away, we should organize society to help enjoy creative and leisure time, not, by the way, cling to having to have a 40-hour work week.
Now, does that mean Sachs is in favor of a universal basic income?
Well, it's funny. I am in favor of universal basic dignity, universal basic needs, universal health care, universal education. The pure cash transfer approach, I find a little naive, actually, though I can see some role for it. I think that the way we meet basic needs to an important extent should not be cash transfers, but should be by helping everybody to be incorporated into the decent systems which give people their health, their education, and their dignity.
So what would Sachs do if we made him chief economist of Earth 2.0?
You don't want to really create Earth 2.0 in the way that you've stated, because we're likely to make a disaster that way. But what I think is extremely important is to have a historical and a moral view. And a historical view says that societies change. They mainly change, in my opinion, because of technological changes. Institutions change as technologies change. We do things differently. We live our lives differently. Instead of working in the fields, we work in factories. Instead of working in factories, the robots work in factories. We work in services. So that's where history comes in. And then values come in by saying that we don't just view ourselves, in my opinion, as an open, unguided evolutionary process. There are some parts of economics, like Austrian economics, will say, well, an economic system is just an open, self-organizing, evolving system, full stop. But I think that that's where the moral framework comes in to ask, as technology changes, as we can do things differently or do, in fact, do things differently, how should we adjust as a social animal living in a society for a decent, ethical world in which we should all be striving to be good people?
To that end, Sachs argues, there are some basic economic considerations to think about.
It wouldn't take almost lifting a finger to make sure that everybody has access to basic health and education in this world, because we're so good, we're so rich, our technologies are so smart. So that's one compelling fact for me, which is that things like nearly 6 million kids under the age of 5 dying each year because they don't get the vaccine or they don't get the antibiotic is just absurd, and I would say obscene. So that's one.
That's one compelling fact, but also you're saying that's part of what we don't want to throw away, because economics, to a degree, is what helped us achieve that wealth. So if you don't want to throw out that baby with the bathwater, correct?
You better believe it. And that's why globalization is an important thing. That's why technology is an important thing. And where, you know, some people say, look at all the downsides of technology, they're incredibly naive. Right now, we're living through our own phenomenal industrial revolution. And what you learn from economic history and from eyes open is that this, again, is absolutely reshaping our lives and will do a huge amount of good for the world if we also combine it with a moral framework. And in the particular case, say, of robotics and automation, it has dawned on a lot of people, and I think correctly, that what is going to happen is that if we're not watching, a lot of people are going to be left behind. And so a debate that says, you know, computers are good, robots are good, robots are bad, is obviously kind of the dumb, naive debate we generally have. They're good in certain ways, but they have side effects that should be handled. All of this is to say that let's get some shared goals. Let's have them meet the morality and the ethics test, that that's decent society. Let's create ways that knowledge and fairness and accountability can really be brought to the table. Let's plan.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening to our first installment of Earth 2.0. We will follow up on this thought experiment in the coming months, and we'll be back next week with another new episode. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe.